The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
For Catholics to continue to be able to contribute to our country, religious freedom is vital. And religious freedom gives us the space to carry out the mission that Jesus has entrusted to the Church. Religious freedom means that Catholics and all people of goodwill are free to seek the truth and to live in accordance with that truth, and so to strengthen our common life as a nation. In the midst of our current challenges, join us as we seek the kingdom and find strength in hope.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. It's good to be back here with you today. Yeah, it's kind of tragic news, isn't it? I just was seeing reports that all five aboard the missing submersible are believed to be lost amid a continuing search right now for the vessel. What a tragedy this is. These men really were true explorers who shared a distinct spirit for adventure and for passion. And I know the families ask that you remember them in your prayers as they grieve the loss of life and going to be going through a very difficult time in the days ahead. This is an unhappy ending to the story. You know, I had just read a story. I didn't actually read it. I just saw a headline this morning that there was another man who was scheduled to be on this trip, or man or woman, I can't even say that because I didn't read the story, but there was a millionaire because it was $250,000 to go on this expedition, pulled out. This millionaire pulled out of the Titan sub-voyage after they paid the deposit. And the reason they pulled out is they cited fears that the operator cut too many corners. So we will learn much more about this in the hours ahead. But, you know, just again, I say pray for the souls of those who've gone before us, and in particular for those who are left behind. Search efforts, of course, were ramped up as oxygen was running out of that sub. And unfortunately, she heard Mary Graham's report. Does not look good. So all five people on that vessel still missing. And a little bit later, I'll take a look at something I've been thinking about. Two things. You know, the story of the Titanic is really an interesting one, and I don't want to get into it right now, but I'll save it maybe for a little bit later in the broadcast. A friend of mine who's a really gifted journalist, I really like him, a wonderful author, he wrote a piece today raising the question as to whether or not the Titanic was cursed. Now, you might think, that's silly, Drew. We don't believe in curses. You know, well, I do. I personally do. I think curses are real. And I think there are things we can do to protect ourselves against them. And do I give them too much credit? No. There are, and I don't want you to fear them either, but there was lots of rumors about it. It was claimed that aboard the Titanic was an Egyptian mummy. Or they thought maybe the lid of a sarcophagus that, so many say, oh, it's cursed, you know, and some really weird things happened when they went into some of the tombs of these pharaohs. Did the ancient Egyptians place curses on these objects or on these people? Can an object carry a curse? I'll share some of that coming up later in the show. It is interesting because you've got here in this particular story, you know, you've got the Titan. You know, the name also of the missing submersible right now, five aboard. And, you know, is it possible that anything associated with this may have fallen under the curse? I'm stretching here a little bit. I'm throwing it out as food for thought, but I thought we could maybe take a look at the hidden workings of curses. And like I said, I'll share if I have a little bit of time later what my buddy wrote. A great story. Kevin Turley will be stopping by a little bit later too, because there was some real heroism, and I really think there was a saint on board the Titanic, and his cause is underway right now. There are reported miracles that have taken place. His name was Thomas Biles, and he heard confessions, and he turned down opportunities to get off the ship so he could administer the sacraments to those who were about to meet the Creator. And his is a great story. Kevin Turley will be by. I'll have him share part of that with you a little bit later. We'll take a look at the Titanic and so much more. So if you ever want to join me, feel free to dial in. The number's 888 914-914-9149. You know, there is footage of experts warning that the sub was not going to be in stable condition, too. One final thought on it, even before it set out. That's why this millionaire pulled out. Here's what the Washington Examiner was reporting. Just check this out.
Pieces of this sub seemed improvised.
We can use these off-the-shelf components.
I got these from Camper World.
Horus Submarine was the subject of concerns from experts and observers over its design and lack of certification by any kind of marine regulatory body. Titan is a Cyclops-class manned submersible, and it went missing while surveying the wreck of the Titanic.
Our crews are working around the clock to ensure that we are doing everything possible to locate the Titan and the five crew members.
And while the submarine has been touted by the company as a state-of-the-art machine, it has come to light experts and observers expressed concerns about several technical features prior to it going missing. In 2018, the Marine Technology Society sent a letter to OceanGate expressing its unanimous concern regarding the Titan submersible.
And again, does not look good for the five people that were on that ship. And just a final thought, and I'm going to move on. They lost contact very early in this expedition. They lost contact about an hour and 45 minutes after the sub or the submersible went below water. They had a 96-hour oxygen supply in total. The amount of breathable air was forecast to run out this morning. And as Mary Graham was reporting there, I was hearing it as I was sitting down in my chair here. What they have found, I believe, is some debris. Maggie, did I hear that correctly? Is that what you heard as well in that particular thing? Maggie's nodding her head, yes. So, as I said, we'll continue to look into this. We'll talk to you a little bit more about it as I get more information. But today, also another big day, and you may not be aware of this, and I don't want to overlook it. I do want to share it with you. Today marks the beginning of Religious Freedom Week, something started by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and they chose two great saints to start it on. Today, of course, is the Feast of St. Thomas More and, of course, John Fisher, and both were beheaded, as you probably know, if you know your history there, by King Henry VIII, who was not satisfied. He needed a child, and, you know, he ended up having some problems with Catherine of Aragon and attempted to marry Anne Boleyn, which he did, but it caused this rupture, the schism in the church, and he acknowledged himself as the head of the Church of England, and, you know, the rest, of course, is history. But Thomas More and John Fisher both would not deny the truth. They would not disavow their allegiance to the Church of Jesus Christ himself established. They died ultimately for marriage. And what an appropriate day to have them as patron saints, because we're on the eve of course, the day in our country, just a couple days away from now, when the Obergefell decision took place. And ultimately, marriage was redefined in this country. And unfortunately, a lot of Catholics supported that. So we are now in a week where I encourage you to go to the USCCB's website. I'm sure Relevant Radio's got great stuff there, too. Check it out and be part of it. You know, the Feast of the Saints, the whole week for religious liberty ends on the Feast of the Saints of Peter and Paul, who also were martyred, right? They were martyred instead by the Roman government for their proclamation of the gospel. But the theme for this year is embracing the divine gift of freedom. And I hope you don't take for granted your freedom. In fact, the bishops are asking us to pray, to reflect, to act throughout the week, and to support religious freedom, not just here in the States, but abroad. And I've been talking about the horrible massacres that have been taking place in places like Nigeria and other places around the world where Christian persecution is rampant. Churches are being destroyed and burned, and where people are losing their lives as a result of it. So, big week. I'll give you more coverage throughout the coming week as well. And, of course, we'll take a look at not just Dobbs tomorrow. That's the one-year anniversary of that, believe it or not, and then the anniversary of Obergefell. So, man, there's something about this time of year, isn't it? You see how active the evil one has been. You see some of these decisions, and you see the fight that is underway. Disney, I want to tell you a quick story about them. I don't know if you're going to go out and see their latest movie. It's called Elemental. Elemental. Thank you, Maggie. To me, it seems very pagan. And that's what Maggie was saying. I couldn't agree with her more. There's that saying, you go woke, you go broke. They debuted this film over the weekend, and it flopped. Absolutely flopped. It was an animated film with their first so-called non-binary character. And I remember seeing this thing advertised. I don't know what I was watching, But it was, you know, they were running these ads like crazy. First, a non-binary character. In the film, they spent about $200 million to make without marketing costs. And it took in, I think, about $28 million, $29 million opening weekend. So the non-binary character may be the reason that it flopped. I don't know. I think parents are kind of tired of this. I don't think parents want their kids exposed to this. You know, I just, it's a common sense thing. Why do you have to go down this lane? Why? Why do you have to do this? Leave parents' children alone. Let parents raise their children, right? It could be that people are going to wait to, you know, go on Disney Plus, or maybe they'll see it somewhere else. But opening numbers were, I think, the worst in 28 years or something like that for that film. So it could be that people are, you know, trying to send Disney a message. Yeah, it could be the bottom line here. We'll see what happens. But here's a little bit more on the bomb that is Elemental. And if you're boycotting Disney, I guess this is another victory in your column. CNBC broke down the financial numbers, and that speaks pretty loudly.
It seems Disney's magic is not inexhaustible. The company's newest animated film, Elemental, facing one of the worst three-day opening weekends in its history.
It did fall short of already lowered expectations. The film just grossed just $29.5 million, which is the lowest opening for a Pixar film when adjusted for an inflation. And it did cost a reported $200 million to make and about another $100 million to market. And critics are flagging that this is Pixar's third disappointment in a row.
$100 million in marketing. I think Bud, I think Target, I think Disney, I think all these companies, you better take a deep breath and you better step back. And look, as shareholders, right, you should be calling, if you have stock in any of these companies, you should be calling that company, right? Sending letters to that CEO. I don't know what the CEO's job is, to have a profitable company, right? Absolutely. This is just bad business. But it doesn't matter, does it? It doesn't matter to them. It's not, for some reason, about the bottom line. It's about something much deeper. It's about advancing a particular ideology. I think it's clear Disney's gone full-fledged woke. Personally, I'm done with Disney. In fact, PragerU, they produced a video that it's pretty cool. They contrasted Disney of the 1990s and 2000s. Maybe that's when you raised your kids, right? Maybe you grew up in the 90s or the early 2000s, right? They contrasted that with the Disney of today, and it featured the show The Proud Family, where cast members celebrated America in the 2000s videos, and then in a recent video claimed America was founded by slaves. Check this out.
The flag stands for us as a group of people being united and being with each other in a time of need.
This country was built on slavery, which means slaves built this country.
The flag means everything to me. It means life, it means freedom, it also means unity, and it means love.
We, the descendants of slaves in America, have earned reparations for their suffering
and continue to earn reparations every moment we spend submerged in the systemic prejudice, racism, and white supremacy.
All the flags, you know, you ride down the street and it makes you feel connected, like we're in this together.
As we celebrate Juneteenth
for the umpteenth time,
our account is still outstanding.
Because this country was built on slavery, which means
slaves built this country.
Listen to the difference in tone, right? And we're talking about a span of 20, 30 years. It's wild. It really is. You've got what kids were exposed to 2 to 3 decades ago, to the anger of systemic racism and prejudice and the flag. I mean, it's just, to me, it's absolutely wild. Maggie, can you cue that back up, or is it too hard? We may not have enough time to do it. All right, well, we won't worry about it. I was going to play it for you again. It really struck me and resonated. I think that's one of the reasons why Pixel's doing so terrible, Elemental, I should say, is doing so terribly, why so many people are frustrated with the agenda that that Disney's advancing. I got to take a short pause. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more. Father Robert Gall is going to be joining me, and we've got a lot to get into. Math scores, by the way, just as a side note, maybe we'll hit on this coming up too. Math and English scores way down in America again. Who's at fault? Is it the teachers? You know, was it COVID? I know we like to blame COVID for all that. We'll take a look at that and how we fare on the international scene and more. Stay with me. I'll be right back.
Your news. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Your news now.
This hour is sponsored by creative planning. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? More information, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Substance without the static. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show.
Great to be with you today. Hey, I want to touch on something happening within the church. We don't talk a whole lot really about what about the synod on synodality. It's a mouthful, right? Starts in October. But I thought we should today, because normally the working documents for the synods don't stir up a whole lot of discussion. But at the Synod on the Family, and now this synod, there's a lot of discussion. And I've invited to join me today, Father Robert Gall. He's an priest of Opus Dei, acting director of the Master's in Ecclesial Administration and Management at the Bush School of Business at Catholic University of America. You can check him out at cua.edu. Great institution. He's here today just to shine some light on this. Father, this could go way over some people's heads, but I do think it's important to talk about. So maybe you can explain what this synod is, why there's controversy coming out, and why it's relevant to all of us.
Yeah, thanks very much, Drew. And indeed, this is really important because it's really at the core of Pope Francis's vision for the church. And I'm really happy that you mentioned these church management programs and the Master's in Ecclesial Administration and Management that we have here at Catholic University, because in a sense, it is an incarnation, if I could use that word, of this vision of Pope Francis of what's also called co-responsibility, which is this idea that within the church, each of us has our own function. And so we shouldn't think of the church as just the bishops or just the priests, but that everyone is baptized as a member of the church and that we are all in this together. And in fact, the word synod comes from Greek, and it's really rooted in the New Testament. And it is a reflection of how Jesus came up upon and accompanied the disciples on the road to Emmaus, and how he then broke the bread with them at the meal. And they saw him in the bread, which meant it was Eucharistic bread. And that this accompaniment is really Jesus who accompanies us, and that it's the Holy Spirit in our inside of us. So what Pope Francis is encouraging the whole church is to, through this synod, is to reflect upon how we are all on a path with Jesus. And crucial for this is understanding where are we going. And the sense of where we're going is really crucial for interpreting the synod. And it's our destination is heaven. It's paradise. And this is why the synod is called, and it's emphasizing in the title of it. It's coming up now in October. It has various phases, and this can get confusing, but this coming phase in October in Rome, it's called Communion, Participation, and Mission. And mission is crucial, because mission is that we're sent by Jesus and we're heading off in order to bring others to Jesus so that we can accompany them on our way to paradise.
Father, I want to play some audio for you as well. And Maggie, can you set this up? Because Maggie had seen an audio clip from, is this a member of the Synod, Maggie, here, this Cardinal? Listen to this.
Yes, this is Cardinal Hollerich from Luxembourg. And, uh-huh. And this clip I just saw yesterday, and I think it's pretty confusing for those of us who are looking at this synod right now.
So we do not speak about the church's teaching. That is not our task and not our mission. That is not our task and not our mission.
So I, when I heard that, I'm thinking, well, what is the mission, Father, and why would we hear something like that? Another Cardinal Pell had a very specific vision of what the purpose of this was all about.
Yeah, this is it's really interesting to hear that that quote. One could take it very negatively, but there's also a positive meaning to it, which is we ought not to see in this new document that's come out in preparation. It's called the Working Document, the Instrumentum Laboris for the upcoming synod. We ought not to see it as an expression of church teaching. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that the church doesn't teach and that we must teach and that there is the truth. In fact, the truth is in Jesus. But rather that these documents do not express that teaching. We should go elsewhere to find that teaching. Okay. So, for instance, this document, the Instrumentum Laboris, talks about polygamy. And it talks about people who are in multiple marital relations. And actually, it uses the word polygamy. And in that same phrase, it talks about LGBTQ plus people. And it says that the church should be welcoming towards them. Now, we know that the church is not in favor of polygamy or of divorce or of adultery, nor is the church in favor of same-sex behavior, same-sex marriage, of course. All of this has been taught. But what the synod is encouraging us is how can we reach out to those people who find them in those situations? In fact, all of us are in sin and we're all in need of redemption. And so the synod is about bringing people to Jesus so that we can all convert, so that we can head on our way to paradise. Cardinal Hollerich, whom we just heard, is from Luxembourg. Now, he is the secretary of the synod, so he's coordinating the documents and he's coordinating the sessions. So I think what he meant by that is that this isn't a synod to teach, but more one to listen to the Holy Spirit.
Gotcha.
And that might lead us to think, well, then, what is this all about? What is going to be the conclusion? Is this just a committee of committees of committees that is just going to produce a lot of gobbledygook? And this was a criticism that Cardinal Pell directed towards what's called the Continental Synod Phase document. It's a summary of summaries of summaries of synods. And he criticized it because of its lack really of Christian basis. But I was really pleased to see in this new, for the final synod portion, working document, Instrumentum Laboris, that it refers to Jesus. Jesus is central and refers to the Holy Eucharist. It refers to the sacraments. So we have the Catechism of the Catholic Church. We have the wonderful magisterium of John Paul II, for instance, on marriage and family. And this is all beautiful. We must accompany one another and be accompanied by the Lord on this path towards paradise, while living out the truth of the gospel that we already understand because it's been taught by the church. So let's keep bringing that with clarity. So Cardinal Hollerich, I think, was referring to the fact that the synod isn't the place of determination of doctrine. It's already been determined.
So the Pope's vision for the synod is, well, what is that? Is it pretty clear, and how can we participate?
Right. The Pope's vision is such that he wants all of us, the baptized, to appreciate that we are called to be church, because each of us is a temple of God through baptism. And this amazingly profound topic that, you know, how often throughout the day do I consider that I'm a temple of God, that God is living within me, that God is my Father, that the Holy Spirit, I can listen to Him and He will inspire me. So Pope Francis wants all of us in the church to be on fire with the Holy Spirit so that we might go out and meet those who do not yet have the gospel and bring it to them. And that's really what this synod is about. It's about going out in order to include everyone in the church, in the sacraments. Yep. Now, that doesn't mean that the church waters down her teaching, because then she would dilute herself.
Yep.
But the church is the body of Christ, is the way to the truth.
Yeah. Well, Father, I want to thank you for being here. I only have a moment left. And if people want to follow this or get more information, I know it can be kind of feel like inside baseball, you know, when it comes to the church. Is there something you want to recommend in terms of reading or be able to clearly understand what's going on and how it will impact them?
Right. There's a sense in which it definitely can come across as inside baseball with all of these meetings. So there's also the process itself may not be especially edifying. And here I'm thinking of the synods that John Paul II ran, in which a lot of the point, I think, from a historical perspective of those synods, was that he was trying to form the bishops who were in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And he was bringing them together so that he would get them on target with the teachings of the church.
Love it.
Now, with this synod of Pope Francis, I think he wants to have a broad impact, not so much with the documents, not so much with what's discussed in the room, but he wants all of us to come to a more acute awareness that Jesus is at our side and that we are called to bring the Holy Spirit to the others.
Well said. Let's grab a call or two. Like I said, I only have a few moments. I've got a jam show today. Phillip's in Chino, California. Phillip, good afternoon. You're on the air with Father Gall. Phillip, go right ahead.
Hello. My comment is that it seems like the synod is an attempt to make the Catholic Church more like the Protestant Church, where it's more horizontal, and it changes the traditional hierarchical structure of the church, where we have lay people in the synod and other faiths in the synod, instead of listening to Jesus Christ.
Well said. Father, I'll let you respond.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Philip. That's a really interesting point. And it reflects very much Cardinal Pell's concerns, because one of the things, so Cardinal Pell wrote an article which was ended up being published post-mortem. It was just after he died, at just before the new year. So at the during the Christmas season, he passed away, and he prepared this article and was published just after he died. And it was this concern about who votes in the Synod. And so historically, it's only been bishops who voted in the Synod. But Pope Francis has opened it up to lay people and who can also have a vote. And it's called the Synod of Bishops. So then one would ask, well, what kind of a church is this? What, how is the hierarchy if lay people vote in the Synod of Bishops? And really, I think the right response is that the Synod has never been such that in that voting process, it's not a democratic process where they determine what the teachings of the church are. Instead, it's the Pope, who's the Bishop of Rome, who is the head of the church, according to his ordination and his succession of St. Peter. Of course, this is extremely Catholic. Yeah. He is the head of the Synod, and the Synod can't do anything without the Pope. And it is the Pope who then confirms the teaching. So it's not that he just has to rubber stamp what these people voted on. The teaching comes from the Pope. And we saw this in the previous Synod of the Amazon, in which there were a number of, I mean, really kind of crazy ideas that were proposed. Yeah. But none of those went through, even if they were proposed and they were debated in the hall.
Right.
The Pope promoted Catholic teaching because he's the Pope. Yeah. So this, where one might see things that seem to resemble the Protestants, the Synod document speaks a lot of ecumenism and how, I mean, they're the Protestants who have maybe a deeper sense that baptism is a call to holiness for everyone. And we can learn, in a sense, from them. Well, this is it's already in the Catholic, the Catholic Church, and it's in Vatican II and Lumen Gentium. We're called to holiness.
Hey, Father, I want to thank you. I wish I had more time. We've got a jam show today, but we'll continue to follow what comes out of there. Appreciate your insight and your expertise. Thanks for being with me today.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah, God bless.
God bless you. That's Father Robert Gall. You can check him out at Catholic University of America. So check him out there. I've got to get to another issue here. As I said, we're jammed today. I hope you can join me. I saw a disturbing number come out recently. The National Assessment of Educational Progress came forward. This is according to the New York Times, which is the gold standard for testing. It showed that the academics in this country are in decline, that 13-year-olds have lost. The scores were at the lowest that we've seen in decades. The last time math scores were this low was back in 1990. For reading, it was 2004. And, of course, you got to wonder why the scores were so low back those years. But you know, that issue doesn't get discussed in the news cycles. But there is another major indicator that shows something is not right with our educational system today. The percentage of 13-year-olds enrolled in algebra has declined 10% in the last 10 years. Now, less than a quarter of them are taking that subject. And in some districts and states, notably California, there's been a push to equalize math education by placing fewer eighth graders into advanced math. And yeah, we're seeing last fall, 69% say they read for fun compared to 78% less kids are reading. And we're seeing these numbers go down. What's it mean? Not just for their future, their ability to be competitive in the marketplace, but what's it also mean for the future of America against other nations that are now certainly outperforming us? I'm joined right now by Dr. Teresa Farnan. She's the author. She's a moral philosopher. She's an educator, and she's the author of the book, Get Out Now, Why You Should Pull Your Child from Public School Before It's Too Late. Good to have you back, Doctor. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for having me, Drew. This is bad news, though, unfortunately, but not unpredictable.
Yeah, no, I'm surprised to see the continued decline. You know, we had COVID, and everybody thought, okay, that explains it. There were masks, there was separation, you weren't in the classroom. But we're still seeing these numbers slide, and I'm surprised. I'm assuming this is not a surprise to you. Give me your assessment of what you're saying. How can the government keep saying public schools are a great thing when we see scores like this continue to diminish?
Oh yeah, no, it's the perfect storm. You have teachers' colleges where they're training teachers to be woke activists. We've had since 2012 the introduction of the Common Core standards, where a lot of progressive ideology was pushed into the schools. And if you remember, one of the controversies with Common Core was specifically about the math curriculum, which had, with its emphasis on sort of like real-world problems that turned out to be really not at all decipherable by parents, highly educated parents who would sit down and try to do their fourth grade child's homework. We saw activism pushed into all of the curricula, in particular reading and literature, all across the curriculum, you know, and we saw this when we did our work for our book. And then with the introduction of all the DEI initiatives and the promotion of social emotional learning, we've really brought kids to a point where any kind of bad test score or objective assessment is deemed to be harmful to them, harmful to their self-esteem. We're teaching them all of this garbage about controlling their emotions through social emotional learning. And at the same time, we've lost kind of a basic understanding of the importance of virtue for human formation and how that sets the stage for education. And so this is the culmination of over a decade of progressive ideology ruling the roost. And if you look at the trajectory of the test scores were low in the 1970s because we were teaching whole language instead of phonics. Remember, we got away from phonics. Then sure. Sometime around the 1990s or so, early 2000s, there was a recognition like kids actually need phonics. And so they brought that back into the classroom. That's when you see the test scores begin to rise. But now we're at the point with these Common Core standards and the, you know, these classrooms that spend more on woke ideology than actually learning, where, you know, there's nothing surprising about this. The only thing that's surprising is that it took so long.
Yeah, no kidding. My concern is this. The U.S. right now, from what I've read, ranks about 36th in mathematics, 13th in reading, 18th in science among all these participating nations. And just to put that number into perspective, you got global competitors like Japan, Singapore, South Korea, consistently outperforming U.S. you know, students in those subjects. And I think the consequence of our low test scores on the international stage, that is going to be far reaching. And we're going to reap the bad fruit of that in the decades to come. I mean, talk about economic vitality and a whole lot of other things that are at stake. Is what's being done, if anything at all? Because there seems to be a trajectory where, you know, our numbers are continuing to degrade. Will they plateau off? Is there something I'm missing here? Apparently other nations are getting it right, right? I mean, are they pushing these mathematics? Are they taking social media away? I mean, what are they doing that is giving them an advantage over the United States of America?
Right. Well, what they're doing is they're actually teaching content rather than ideology, right?
Yeah,
so
I
remember when my kids were in school, people would look at what the kind of math they would teach in Singapore, and it was very basic. It was math problems. It was a lot of calculation. You had to memorize. You had to learn how to actually do problems, and then you would solve problems over and over again because repetition builds learning. And so they were, these other countries are focusing on the basics, while at the same time, in some of these countries, you can see a return to the idea that busy work in the classroom isn't necessarily of educational value. And so while we're going full steam ahead with early preschool and trying to get everybody into Head Start programs, which have never proven have any kind of measure of success, they're dialing back kindergarten and recognizing that kids need time for creative play.
Yes,
but I mean, what do I think is going to happen? The usual. Randy Weingarten is going to be in Washington, D.C. demanding more money, and we're going to spend more money on failing schools. But here's the bright point, I think, right now in the landscape, which is that we have had a wave of school choice bills sweeping through the country. And with every one that's brought forward, the school choice becomes more and more robust. In other words, it's offered to more families. It's not just it's in failing school districts. And we know that same 2022 NEAP test scores showed that the Catholic schools far outperformed the public schools.
That's
right?
Wild.
And
that's wild.
We're not talking about this in the long-term trends.
Yeah, one of my colleagues here, Nick, pointed out, he said he heard that there have been comparisons between U.S. and other countries that they, you know, part of the problem with some of these comparisons, they don't measure student populations equally. For example, they'll measure the aggregate U.S. scores against specific populations within countries, which make our scores appear even worse than they really are. So, you know, the trouble could run a lot deeper than we think. Let me grab a quick call for you. We'll go to Joanna, who's in Highland, New York. Hi, Joanna. Good afternoon.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment. I've seen you, Dr. Hansen, on EWTN, and I saw your book also, and what you do is wonderful, so thank you. And I just wanted to comment that I pulled my children out 3 years ago from the public school due to many of the things that were going on, including their lack of education, but also that the schools were pushing more of their ideology on my children than what they were actually learning. Yeah. And also, I wanted to raise them in the Catholic faith, and so I'm done with the public schools. Uh-huh. And I recommended your book to my friend, who I'm trying to get her to pull her kids out to. So
wow. Good for you.
Thank you for what you do.
God bless you.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. And actually, I mean, what this highlights is, if you look at these test scores, you see the lowest drop in performance in the lowest performing group, right? And so this is something we have to take really seriously. This is a social justice issue. We've got to give parents options. Parents need to, parents in school districts like the Philadelphia yeah. public schools desperately want to get their kids out of those schools. So we've got to, you know, I'm so happy for you. I'm happy you got your kids out. I think the you know, that should be the goal, to give parents control over their education so they can hold these school districts accountable.
That's right.
But, you know, the flip side of this is that in Catholic schools, we see the growth of the classical school movement, which returns children to reading, wow. to math, to writing, to literature, in a recognition that that's how to help kids learn.
Well, Joanna, thank you for your call. I do appreciate it. Dr. Farnan, I want to thank you for your time as well. Really, I'm grateful for the insight you provided. People want to get your book. I know it's impacting a lot of lives. How's the best way to pick up the book?
Well, you could either go through Regnery. Amazon hasn't banned it yet, but I think it's still available there. Or you could just order it directly from Regnery, which you know, they're courageous enough to keep publishing controversial books. So I appreciate that very much.
Well, thank you very much. The book is called Get Out Now, Why You Should Pull Your Child Out of Public School Before It Is Too Late. The author, Dr. Teresa Farnan. That's F-A-R-N-A-N. I have to take a very short break here. Stay with me when we come back. I'm going to give you an update on the Titan, the submersible, the news is not good. I'll fill you in on that. Kevin Turley will be joining me as well. There is a heroic story, somebody connected to the Titanic. You'll hear that story right after this. Stay with me. There's more to come. Hey, if you have real estate or land that you no longer need, well, consider the advantages of donating it to Relevant Radio. The process is easy and the tax advantages can be huge. Learn more at relevantradio.com/property.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, it's good to be here with you today. Hey, thank you so much for joining me. Following the story on the Titan, the missing submersible. Tragic story if you're just tuning in. Pieces of that missing submersible have been reported to be found on the ocean floor about 1,600 feet from the bow of the Titanic. So they were very close. The Coast Guard was at least reporting that moments ago. The operator of the submersible said that, you know, our hearts are with all these five souls. All five people aboard that craft went missing, as you know, on Sunday. I was sharing it with you earlier. They had about 96 hours worth of oxygen. So it really was a race against time to try to find them. They didn't know whether they were tangled in the Titanic's debris. They don't know whether the ship imploded or lost communication or it surfaced and was bobbing somewhere in the Atlantic. But earlier in the day, a remote-controlled vehicle located the debris from this submersible, including the tail cone, found that on the ocean floor about 1,600 feet away from the bow of the Titanic. And it was very consistent with what they believe happened, a catastrophic implosion of the vessel. So there must have been a structural failure in the depths. The pressure of those depths just absolutely crushed the ship. Even as chances for survival seemed to grow slim, rescuers continued to go ahead and to hold out hope. So my heart goes out to the families, and we will certainly pray for their souls. You know, I had read a commentary I don't know how long ago it was, maybe a couple years ago. I forget when I saw this, to be honest with you. I just remember how good it was. It was written by a friend of the show here, Kevin Turley. I know you know him. He's a very prolific writer and he's a radio host too. He does a fantastic show. He's London based. He's a journalist. He's a filmmaker, show host. And we'll get you connected to all that info on our social media. But, if you haven't followed him, do a quick search for his name. His writing appears regularly in publications on both sides of the Atlantic. National Catholic Register is one of those great publications and a regular contributor on EWTN. And he shared the story of a priest, who years ago, when the Titanic was struck, when it struck that iceberg and was going down on April 14th, 1912, this priest stayed on the deck of that ship. A ship that was supposed to be unsinkable. And he heard confessions. He even refused a seat on a lifeboat that would have offered him his own life. And it's such a great story. Kevin Turley is a wonderful storyteller. And rather than me tell it to you, I invited him to share this remarkable tale. Kevin, great to have you back. Good afternoon.
No, Drew, it's an absolute pleasure to be with you and your audience, as always.
Now, I appreciate it. We called you last minute, but when I heard about the destruction of the Titan, I thought, there is, surrounding the Titanic, so many different stories. Some believe it's cursed, but this is one of the greats, the story of a heroic priest whose cause is now open and what he did those final hours. So I'm just going to give you the floor. Could you share the story with us?
Sure, be delighted to. So the story starts really effectively towards the end of 1911. Father Thomas Biles is appointed parish priest of St. Helen's Church in Essex, which is a county east of London. And one day he received an invitation from his brother to come and officiate at his brother's wedding, which was going to take place in St. Augustine's Catholic Church, 6th Avenue, Brooklyn, New York City. And it was going to take place on April 21st, 1912. So Father Biles booked his crossing, and initially he booked, he was with the White Star Line and he booked a ship. But because of industrial action, they weren't able to place him on the ship that he booked on. So they put him on the new ship, which we know was RMS Titanic. So it was Easter week when Father Biles left his rectory and headed off to London, got on the boat and headed off. On that, there's one letter that came from the ship. The ship touched Ireland. It went into a port in Ireland briefly, picked up more passengers before heading out into the North Atlantic. And he wrote to his elderly housekeeper, and he was writing about temporal concerns and spiritual concerns, Drew, because he feared he had lost his umbrella while traveling on the train to the dock. But more importantly, he said that he would not be able to say Mass until the ship had cleared the Irish port of Queenstown. But after that, he expected to be able to say Mass every single day. And that's very, very important. That's the last communication we have from him. So it was the maiden voyage, as we all know. There were 2,435 people on board. It was claimed to be unsinkable, as you said, and the passengers were from all social classes and lots of different nationalities. As we know, there were three priests on board. There was Father Biles, a priest from Bavaria, and another priest from Lithuania, all heading to the United States to make their life there. Now, as the ship traveled through the Atlantic, Father Biles was berthed in the second class, but most of his work, most of his pastoral activity was in steerage, which, as you know, is where the cheapest berths are. And most of the passengers there, many of them were Irish. So he spent a lot of his initial days there sort of tending to their needs. Saturday, April 13th was the first day that he was able to hear confessions, and he did so for hours that day in preparation for Sunday, which just happened to be Low Sunday. And I don't need to tell you, Drew, that today Low Sunday is better known as Divine Mercy Sunday. Mm-hmm. And when Sunday did come, he said Mass for the passengers in steerage, and he gave a sermon that day about basing it on a passage from St. Paul about how we need faith as a lifeboat in the ever-changing waters of life. How apt. And then that Sunday afternoon, he continued the devotions with the passengers, and they all got together and they recited the rosary and prayed together, etc. So the unsinkable Titanic plowed on through the Atlantic and all appeared to be well. It was a total illusion, of course, as we know. 11:40 p.m., alarms started sounding, and they started sounding very wildly, so much so that people immediately started to panic, by all accounts. And what did Father Biles do? Well, he immediately went down into steerage. And the first thing he did was to try and calm everybody by asking for silence. And the frightened crowd gradually quietened down. And then, and this is very important, he led all present in a very profound act of contrition. This is a man who had his priorities right. I'm sure you'd agree, wow. Drew. In a situation like this, he understood the danger and he immediately said, we must say an act of contrition together. So he explained the dangers to the passengers, and then he started to escort the women and the children from the storage to the deck to get on to the various lifeboats that were being offered. By all accounts, and these are accounts of survivors who witnessed this, he worked quickly and calmly, ushered the ladies and the children onto the lifeboats. And one of the characteristics that's referenced is his presence of mind as he was doing this. Everybody else was losing their minds at this time. He wasn't. He was very much in control of himself. He escorted them to the top, put them on the boats, was offered a place on the boats, declined it, went straight down again to collect more of the women and children and bring them up through the decks. And the atmosphere, as you can imagine, as we've seen on films and read in books, was getting more and more fraught. If for a moment I could just pause there, sure. Drew, and give you a little bit of background, because I think it's important to understand Father Biles. He was born in 1870 in England, and he went to university as a Protestant, an evangelical Protestant. He embraced Anglicanism there. But then through a study of the church fathers, a bit like Newman, he came to an understanding that it was the Catholic Church was the true church. And on the Feast of Corpus Christi, he was received into the church, the Jesuit church in Oxford, and took the religious name of Thomas. But after that, his life was a little bit difficult in that he went to the seminary, but he had ill health. He was poorly in health. He wasn't very well. So he was he had to leave the seminary, tried teaching for a while. That didn't work. And then he managed to sufficiently restore his health to go back to the seminary. And he finally was ordained a priest in 1902. And even his ministry in London was all over in England was all over the place. He was sent initially to London, but it was a bit too pressured for him. It was a bit too difficult for him. So he was sent out to this country parish to convalesce. And it was there he got the telegram from his brother asking if he would come and officiate at the Mass. So we have this priest standing on the deck, and again he's offered a lifeboat. Again he declines, and the final lifeboat disappears into the surrounding darkness. And he stood there with 1,516 souls still on board the deck. There's various reports about what was happening on the deck, but they had earlier brought up the ship's band to try and calm people, you know, by playing jolly popular tunes. But by this stage, the band was playing hymns. Now, there's all sorts of disputes as to what the hymns are. I don't think that really matters. One of the hymns that's alleged to be played is Abide With Me, which I'm sure you know that hymn, Drew. But as the ships were, the lifeboats were going away, they could see the passengers left on board the deck, and they could definitely see Father Biles stood there, and how the prayers and the hymns were now mingled with wailing to some extent. And then as the sort of final dark waters started to come onto the deck, it is said that Father Biles lifted himself to the highest position on the deck. And in one final priestly act, he raised his hand in one last act of blessing and absolution for all present. And then with his crucifix and his rosary in his hand, he once again began to lead them in prayer, the prayer of the rosary, as the band continued to play. And you know, Abide With Me as well as I do. And I looked it up the other day, and the text, as we know, says, Abide with me. Fast falls the eventide, the darkness deepens. Wow. Lord, with me abide. Hold thy cross before my closing eyes. In life, in death, O Lord, abide with me.
Wow, that's something else. Wow. Kevin, what an amazing story. I know that he gave his life. He laid it down in a heroic fashion. His cause is now open. And I would just invite those who are listening to call upon the power of his intercession. He had his eyes truly focused on what mattered, and that's our true home. It's eternity. Kevin, thank you. I know you wrote about that years ago. I don't know how long ago. People wanted to share that story with someone else in light of this tragedy with the Titan. How do they contact you or track that down?
I think the story is called, and you'll like this, Drew, Divine Mercy and the Sinking of the Titanic, and it's on ncregister.com.
I'm going to have to go look it up again. I just remember it. That's fantastic. Hey, brother, thank you very much for making time
thank
for
you,
us
Drew.
Today. I'm about to pray the chapel. I'll remember you and your family, okay?
Absolutely. And I don't know who your new producer is, Mrs. Caruso, but she's very, very good.
Yeah, she's not bad.
You should keep her.
She's much more calm than my other one. So, Kevin, thanks.
Congratulations, Maggie.
Maggie, Maggie Caruso. That's her married name now. Say Maggie, right? Sweet as can be. And a pro. Does a great job. She'll be praying the chapel with me when I return. If you want to join us, you can get in now. 888-914-9149. We'll pray for the souls of those who've gone before us and call upon the intercession of this heroic priest, Father Biles.